so often that I listen to it. Not that I mind it, and I don't enjoy it.
Madam Chairman and Senators, thank you for the privilege of permitting me to speak in support of Senate Bill 163. I'd like to introduce myself. I'm a private citizen. I live at 951 Lakefront Road, Lake Oswego. I'm presently engaged in the practice of law in the Standard Plaza building in Portland, where I make my office. I have been a party plaintiff in a class action, and as a circuit judge, I have been a party defendant in a class action. So I've had some experience as a litigant, and I would like to make just these simple observations. If the wrongs that are inflicted upon society generally today are ever to be remedied, we must have in Oregon a class action bill along the same lines that they have in the federal court, because there are many causes involving citizens within the state that cannot otherwise be remedied, primarily because the amount involved is usually so small that no aggrieved person can afford to hire an attorney to write that amount. The second point I wish to make is that any time that you hamstring either the litigant or the attorney who represents the litigant, insofar as the allowance of reasonable attorney's fees are concerned, you just as effectively deny him his day in court as if you prohibited the action altogether. The third point that I wish to make is that the provision for opting in or opting out of a class action goes to the very heart of the proceeding. Just the other day, I received notice of a class action that was brought in the federal court in California, and I had the option to stay in or get out. And obviously, since I was a very small member of that class and couldn't afford to hire an attorney to represent me, I opted to stay in. Certainly, I should not be denied that privilege. I ought not to have to do some affirmative act in order to stay as a member of that class when the dollars and cents to me is rather trivial. I now am considering whether to or not to participate in still a third class action, where the loss to me by the unscrupulous dealings amounted to less than $1,000. To the members of that class, I am sure the loss amounted to several millions of dollars. But as an individual, and even as a qualified attorney where I could act for myself, though it is often said that one who is an attorney and represents himself has a fool for a client, I can't afford that kind of litigation over so small a sum. So obviously, if people are injured, they should have access to our court, and they ought to have that access in a body, and it ought to be to the state court and not just to the federal court. You all know, of course, that both Washington and California have such laws, and that those laws have redounded to the benefit of the ultimate consumer in the most trivial of cases, insofar as the individual personal loss is concerned. And I urge you sincerely to act favorably on this bill in behalf of the little people who are hurt and who need relief, and that in doing so, you ought not to rob it of these very valuable provisions, allowing them to pay their attorneys, if you please, either on a contingent fee basis or on some reasonable basis fixed by the court. It ought not to be limited to an hourly basis. Now, It's all right, and I agree with the premise that defense counsel for the big firm and defense counsel for the big company that day after day are specializing in this field should be paid on an hourly basis. But bear in mind, they get paid for the very day, from the very day and the very minute that the first letter is received from a client. The average lawyer isn't so paid. The average lawyer isn't paid until he's thoroughly investigated the case and determined whether or not one exists. He can't be paid on an hourly basis. He can't possibly be compensated for his time in these days of high overhead, where approximately half of every dollar taken in goes for overhead, if he operates that way. Yet the defense lawyer, on the other hand, is not so required. Most often he's on retainer, and he certainly is paid for every single letter he writes or everything that he does in connection with his defense of the case. That's one advantage he has. The other advantage he has that properly entitles him to compensation on an hourly basis is that he's a specialist in that field. And he has time to devote all of his energy to being a specialist in that field, because the other members of the firm are taking care of the various other specialties that the firm enjoys. This very day, there are over 2,000 attorneys meeting at the Coliseum in Portland, learning from the specialists, both the plaintiff lawyers and the defense lawyers who specialize in personal injury cases, what the tricks of the trade are, so to speak. But this expertise is not enjoyed by everyone. Not everyone is capable of presenting a particular type of case. And if someone possesses that expertise, he ought not to be limited to the same hourly base as a neophyte. I submit that if he were paid his worth as a consequence of the result obtained, or if he were paid his worth as on the basis of the productive hours that he put in, you'd have a far more reasonable basis of compensation. And this is exactly what will happen if you leave the matter of attorney's fees to be set by the court in such amount as may be reasonable. Or in the alternative, if you leave the fee to be fixed by a contingency agreement, subject to revision by the court if it seems to be outrageous. Now, this is, as I see it, the only way that the small man is ever going to have his rights adjusted in this vast area of litigation and in the vast number of wrongs that have been occasioned him for generations. I think in closing, I have only one other comment to make, and that is that this particular bill will not create a workload on the court. That's purest folly. As it stands now, there is an equity maxim that says equity avoids a multiplicity of suits. What is equity? Equity is doing justice to our fellow man. Now, if equity avoids a multiplicity of suits, how much better is it to have a class action representing all of these little people than it is to have literally dozens of class actions for little people? If it's all combined in one trial, in one issue, and the wrong is righted, are you not ultimately saving the time of all concerned? Not only the court, but the poor people themselves. Also bear in mind, if you will, please, that any litigation that you have is always a strain and a stress on the litigant. Some litigants are reluctant to seek redress of their rights. As a matter of fact, I have a case now involving a lady who was horribly injured, and she's reluctant to go to court. She's reluctant to present her case to the court because the physical and mental stress and strain is too great. Now, I'm certain you have people like this who are involved with grievances that could be served in a class action. And such an individual in a class action would not be deprived of a remedy because she could rely on the other people who were willing to represent the entire class and present their views for adjudication. So I submit to you that it's long past due that the state of Oregon have a class action statute. Thank you again for your courtesies and your time.
Judge Dixon, there may be questions. I assume you're standing up because you want to. You're welcome to have a chair.
Well, thank you. I prefer standing on my
feet. All right.
Judge, you were a circuit court judge in Multnomah County, how long?
For almost 18 years, a month and a half short of 18 years.
And you went into private practice again when?
I went in private practice again on November the 15th last year.
Okay. And like, especially because of your role as a judge, but like most lawyers, you're concerned about creating any law that will affect the workload of the court. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Now, a lot of these small enough, I suppose, piecemeal could be brought in our lower courts, district courts, and small claim courts, and so forth. But because of the traffic situation and so forth, we find them for the ones with the backlog. Is that correct?
Senator, if you were to make a trip to the first floor of the Multnomah County Courthouse at 9 o'clock on any morning of the week, you would find out that the lower courts are the busiest courts of all. They remind me of a busy intersection when the office staff are let out of the office building. The lower courts are the ones that are really crowded and really jammed.
So you see it desirable as putting all these kind of cases, to the extent that they are part of that backlog down there, together in a circuit court as one case would be desirable insofar as reducing the amount of litigation in Oregon court?
There's no question in my mind but what it would result in a considerable saving of time to the courts to have all of these claims combined in one action. It would be an impossible load for the lower courts to handle as they are now constituted. You would need many times the manpower that you now have if all of these remedies were brought in, or rather all of these claims were brought in the lower court.
Thank you, Judge.
Do any of you have any further questions?
Further questions, Senator
Hart? You spoke about the Oregon, Western California. Are you familiar with the Western California laws that had to do with class action suits?
Only in passing. I know of the cases that have been tried there.
Are you familiar with the statute?
No, I am not.
Thank you.
I'm familiar with Rule 23 in the federal court, and I understand that those statutes are patterned after Rule 23, but that's the extent of my knowledge. I think Mr. Carey, who is present in the audience, is more familiar and could answer you more directly concerning the terms of those specific statutes.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you very much for your kindness.
Henry Carey.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, Senators. My name is Henry Carey. My office is at 1004 Standard Plaza. I'm a lawyer, and I've engaged rather extensively in class action litigation in the last 3 or 4 years in federal court under Rule 23. Senator, to answer your question first, if I may, the Washington statute is virtually identical to Senate Bill 163 or the federal Rule 23. The state of California has a statute which is almost identical to Oregon's existing statute under the Field Code, except that it uses the word action, or our statute uses the word suit, and that has prompted the difficulties that we had in the courts when we tried to bring actions for damages here last year. And you probably know the Oregon Supreme Court in the AT&T case ruled that under the interpretation of our existing statute, you cannot bring an action to recover damages, although you can get injunctive relief. For that reason, that I came here today to support Senate Bill 163 in its existing form and hopefully without any amendments. I was the first inclined not to come here because my work is largely in this field, unless it be thought that there were some economic or pecuniary interest of my own, but when I read in the paper the comments by my one of my favorite adversaries, Norman Wiener, and Mr. Biggs about this monster, the Frankenstein monster, and the difficulties you're going to have. I couldn't resist coming down here and at least responding in part to those statements. First of all, in addition to, I endorsed everything that Judge Dixon has said. I know that Judge Charles Crookham, who recently was the president of the Circuit Court Judges Association of Oregon, has written a letter to this committee in support of this bill. I've also had conversations with five or six other circuit judges in Multnomah County, all of whom agree. I'd like to address myself first to the charges that there will be a tremendous burden on the court. We're involved in litigation in several major cases in Southern California, and I think that California is having difficulties now. There are a tremendous number of cases that have been filed, and a lot of them are spurious cases. But I submit to you that the judges themselves have no difficulty with that kind of a problem. In the securities field, I think the statistics at the present time would show, and in the federal court, that in approximately 40% of the cases in which class action status is sought, the judges deny that, and they do it on the basis of the preliminaries. They look at the merits of the underlying case, and they just deny the class action. As far as the clutter of the court's calendar or the time that's involved, I might just tell you briefly what's involved in it. When the case is filed, the lawyer files a motion for determination of class action. It's generally filed with the complaint. And the only time, very frequently, the only time that the court has involved in these things is in sitting on the bench, examining the documents, and listening to the arguments on the determination of class action. If the lawyer is at all careful, he's going to have to be sure in this type of litigation that he's right before he files the lawsuit. And he has to be right on the merits because it's a tremendous investment of dollars. And we have cases, the security cases, with say over 2,000 hours. Well, it means an investment that we have to carry for years of $50,000 to $60,000 is not unusual in the case, and therefore you have to be right and you have to look at it very carefully. And that cuts down, or will cut down in a very short time, the bad cases that might be filed. The only other thing I'd like to relate to this committee is the background, which I rather imagine that the defense attorneys who appeared before this committee may not have told you, and that is the case that went to the Oregon Supreme Court. It was a case that was filed against both the U.S. and First National Bank, alleging an overcharge to the borrowers of the bank by use of what we call the artificially short year. The banks were computing interest on promissory notes, as a general practice, without telling their borrowers, and where the note said, and I think most all of us had borrowed from a bank, but it said X percent, 6%, 7% per annum. Most of us would have thought that we were being charged on a per annum based upon 365 days. We discovered that it wasn't 365, it was 360 days. Now, the consequence of that was that as far as the people of the state of Oregon, these two banks, and I think you could take judicial notice of this because it's in the newspapers and the call reports every quarter, have assets and loans substantially in excess of $1 billion each. Now, the effect of using that 360 against 365 days made it possible for the bank to realize 1.399, 1.4% more of income than they would if they'd used a 365-day year. The effect on any borrower, minimal. And this is the argument that these are so trivial in amounts that why bring it on. As far as the banks were concerned, it goes something like this. We had a chart before the Supreme Court to refer to in this argument. We take a hypothetical $1 billion, keeping in mind that their loans are actually about $1.3 billion. And if you take an 8% interest rate against that $1 billion, and it's higher now probably on average, that's $80 million of interest income a year. And then you apply the 1.4% or 1.399%. What it meant was, and has meant, that the banks, each one of them are taking somewhere in the neighborhood of $1,300,000 a year out of the pockets of Oregon consumers. Between the two of them, over $2,600,000. So that was the case that we took as a class action to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, in its wisdom, said that under the language of our particular statute, inasmuch as the word suit was used instead of action, they denied relief and said it's a matter for the legislature. But there are a great many of them. I suspect that every member of this committee probably has an automobile, or a gasoline cars with one of the major oil companies, and a great many people have come to us and said they resent the 18% charge that's made on it, 1.5%. That's usurious. It's in excess of the interest rate that's allowed by law. And those cards on the back of them very frequently say that the rate of 18% is only chargeable in these states, but in others it's governed by the usury law of the state.
Senator Hoyt has a card with Farmers Co-op.
But there's no remedy in Oregon, because who's going to hire a lawyer? What lawyer can afford to take on a case like this for damages? But a class action that'll stop just like that, and there'll be loads of lawyers that will take it. I guess I have distributed to each of the senators a packet with some comments. I reference just to one part of it. I know you're so busy and have so many things to read, you probably won't have time to go through this material, but there is an excellent article that I attached, written by one of the distinguished practitioners in this field, Mr. Abraham L. Pomeranz. And in furtherance of what Judge Dixon said, he took one brief paragraph on page 109. He said, "Across my desk over the years, I've had occasion to say to a prospective client more often than I like to remember, 'Sorry, sir, but your $500 or $1,000 claim will cost you more than that to prosecute. You'd better forget about the whole business. How about justice? How about due process?' And this is what we're doing. We have so many of these cases. The lawyer has to say, 'Oh, I'm sorry, it is bad, it's wrong, but there's nothing we can do about it.' So with a class action, those things will be remedied."
Question to Mr. Perry.
Thank you very much.
Senator Keith Burns.
Down there?
Wherever you like.
Leslie says I have to go down there.
Well, who's in charge?
Well, she runs the machine over there, of course. Well, we know who's in charge,
I'm not sure what that meant.
This bill, I think, carries this committee's sponsor on it, but no, we signed up. Okay, that's right. Several of us signed it. It was, I'm the principal sponsor of the bill, and I feel very strongly about this. I think it's just a coincidence in Oregon law that we don't have class action today, because the word suit has been narrowly interpreted by our courts. It means there can be no action for damages, no class action for damages. And I want to tell you about one class action suit that was successful in Oregon, where the court didn't rule that way. And it was a relatively small suit. It's one that I handled. And I think it's typical of the type of lawsuits you would see occur. All of them are against great big institutions. Some of them are against state agencies. I represented a client in a divorce suit. She was awarded the family residence. And they had a loan from the State Department of Veterans Affairs, which we all consider to be an organization with a heart. But as you know, the law used to be that if you transfer from one veteran to another a loan, then the rate remained the same at 4%. But then if you transfer it to a non-veteran and they took the loan over, then the non-veteran would pay 5%. Subsequently, you know, we changed the law when the rate of interest for the bonds went up, and then the loan rate was set at the last rate they had to pay for the money for the bond. And statute says if the property is transferred to a non-veteran, then you pay at the rate that they had to pay for the last bond. So my clients, neither one of them were veterans, they'd taken over a loan from a veteran at a time when the rate goes up to 5%, and that's what they were paying. Then we had the divorce suit, where my client, the former wife, was awarded the family residence. And the Department of Veterans Affairs construed that as a transfer, the divorce decree. And she's a non-veteran, and they raised the interest rate to 8.3 from 5%. And I found that they were doing this all the time whenever they discovered, whenever the people were honest, and letting the Department of Veterans Affairs know that there had been a divorce, they were raising the interest rate for the wife of the non-veteran, raising it to a relatively exorbitant rate under the laws, contrary to its intent. And in spite of letters to the Department of Veterans Affairs, to the Attorney General's office, they would not change it back. They said that was their interpretation. Transfer included by way of a divorce decree. So I filed a class action just as if I was under Rule 23 of the federal courts. And because it was a relatively small suit, I think we ended up with 38 or 48 people in the class. And because it didn't cost the Department of Veterans Affairs very much money, why the judge required them to send out the notices, required the people to opt out if they wanted to. One or two, three or four did. And we went through the discovery process just as if we were in the federal court. And finally got the trial, and we prevailed. On attorney's fees, the court didn't get involved because I sent out a letter to all the clients and told them they got back two things. I mean, they got two things out of it. One thing, they were returned the cash that they paid in. Overcharged on interest rate. Some of them got $54, some of them $300, some of them $150. But the thing was, all down the line for maybe 15 years, they had the interest rate reduced in many instances by more than 3%, which amounted to a lot of money to them. And for instance, on a $25,000 house for 25 years, 2% means $7,000. So you can imagine how much that saved those people. Well, I was more interested in establishing a procedure for a class action in the state of Oregon than I was particularly in attorney fees, and because I thought it was inequitable that we did not have class action. And so I just sent a letter out to them and told them that any that received less than $100, forget about it. Any that received $100 or more, 25% of the amount, and that compensated me some, and I was very happy with it. I said, or we can go to court and have the judge set it. And I said, I am confident the court would set a higher fee for reasonable time involved. I think that was the case. No doubt my mind that was the case. And they are all very happy and sent it in and got glowing letters. They thought, I'm really made myself a hero. Found some of them in Arkansas and various other places. But this is the kind of thing that we're talking about. But now when a big one comes along, then the court, and there's a commercial interest as opposed to state agency, the courts have ruled very strictly on this. And the Supreme Court now has ruled on it. Said that you cannot have a class action. So you can see in a situation like that, a state agency could charge these people 3% more on the interest rate, contrary to law, because the court held that a transfer does not include a decree of a divorce case. Both the people signed that note for that loan. Both of them are on the document. It's just going to one of the spouses. And so that can be the kind of case we're talking about, too. Now, there's a couple other things I want to mention to you. The legal aid attorneys and the attorneys from, I'll just say AOI as a general classification of them. They represent different organizations, J.C. Penney, Montgomery Ward, and so forth. I worked hard on some proposed amendments that you have in your packet. There's Charlie Williamson's name in the upper right-hand corner. And there's many of them in there. These are amendments that the opponents wanted, a lot of them to which the legal aid attorneys, and I've gone over this briefly, agreed to. There's some they disagree on. Since that time, there's some others that have come in from the AOI, and I don't know if you have them or not in your packet. I think you do. They're titled AOI ORC Comments on Legal Aid Amendments to Senate Bill 163. And there's some language there that would not be opposed by the proponent, and I suggest that they have them sit down and work it out, that language. And I would hope that this would come back on the docket here, on the agenda soon. It's getting very late. We're going to have a class action bill this session. We're going to have to get it out. But I would suggest that they work that out. Now, the big thing we're going to have, there's two things we're going to have before. That's on attorney's fees. The amendments that the AOI wants says hourly basis. Well, that doesn't work very well. And most attorneys who handle these kind of lawsuits, like myself, I do quite a few civil rights suits in the federal courts, and they provide for reasonable attorney fees. In every single case where I've prevailed, we work out the attorney fees between the attorneys and gone in and had the court approve them. The court wasn't even involved. And I'd suggest in most instances that's what would occur. But I think the courts are in a peculiarly good position to set the attorney fees. And I don't think it should be on an hourly rate. A lot of times an attorney is doing something that can relate to more than one case, and it's very difficult to sort out what you do to one case and what you do to another. And I think reasonable attorney fees is the way to have it. The other big thing we're going to have to face is the opt-in, opt-out class action controversy. In my opinion, if you leave it to opting in, I think it's questionable whether we ought to pass the bill out or not. I think it virtually wipes out class actions. And I'd like to just take a minute to tell you why. The experience in class actions has shown that a large proportion of the members of a class, probably over one half, will not respond to a court notice that they are a class member. Now, probably all of us here received one from when the Attorney General brought a lawsuit in the federal court. Can't remember what it was on. This is not a piece of paper, you know, that is printed up that just zeroes in on your attention. It's something more like an advertisement of some kind, what you get. And so it's something that you might well throw away.
Thank you,
Billy. Most of the people that get a notice like this will not either opt in nor will they opt out. And the reasons for the lack of response are many, and I'd like to go over some of them with you. One, the poor and illiterate fear of the legal system tend to ignore court papers even when they stand to lose a great deal by their inaction. And I can tell you that from personal experience. A large part of my clientele are people who are among the working and non-working poor. And so often, they come to you and they had a judgment taken against them by default. But it isn't limited to the poor. Some people who should know better, but they're under great financial pressures, and they'll be sued, and they won't respond. They won't go to an attorney. And they come in after the judgment's already been taken from them. Well, if they won't respond to that type of personal sanction, then I think it's some evidence of what you do when you get something that looks no more different than a Safeway ad in coming from a court clerk. One of the other reasons is the fear of the legal system. It's compounded by legal notices indicating that you are a party to a lawsuit, and your rights will be forever determined, which is typical language that you find in one of these notices. The fear and ignorance make people resist getting involved. Another reason is many fear they might have to produce long-lost sales slips or receipts, and maybe even go to court for a day, which is not the case. You have three or four representatives come in to represent the type of damages that they've suffered. And it just simply isn't worth the trouble to them for the small amount involved, and they think that's what they're going to have to do. Class members may lose notices, move, and never receive them. Opponents of a meaningful class action bill argue that a defendant who has cheated potential class members should be entitled to keep funds illegally obtained from class members who fail to file notices with the court. But this would entitle a defendant to retain illegally obtained proceeds simply because of the fear, ignorance, or the uncertainty of class members. Proponents argue that a person should not be required to opt in, but anyone can opt out simply by notifying the court. Thus, wrongdoers would not be allowed to benefit from the class member's propensity not to respond to class notices. After an action is litigated, the court generally notifies the class member that you are entitled to a refund of a certain computed amount. The percentage of persons responding to such notice is much greater than those responding to a notice that the action is pending and that you will be forever bound by the result. Further, in some cases, courts have ruled that illegally obtained funds need not be returned to class members, but require that they be applied to keep future rates down. In such cases, the expense of mailing notices and recovery checks might eat up the amount of the recovery. Yet, illegally obtained funds should not remain in the hands of the wrongdoer. Thus, in the yellow cab case in California, which has been mentioned to us by witnesses, where the cab meters were rigged, future taxi fees were reduced because of the past overcharge. The number of cab riders opting into such a class action would have been very small. Yet a real class existed there, and they were able to benefit substantially by a class action. No such benefit would have resulted had an opt-in rule been in effect in California. The federal courts previously followed stringent opt-in rules requiring the intervention by class members. But this was changed in 1966, however, to the opt-out. And Senate Bill 163, in its present form, is an opt-out piece of legislation. Oregon should benefit from the federal experience and adopt the opt-in alternative presented in
Senate Bill 163, in my opinion. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Smith, the witness is Senator Keith Burns.
Why is he sitting there instead of in his place?
Because Leslie said I had to.
He wants to be in the spotlight. He's up in the television.
Right. Oh, Leslie said I had
to. He's got a blue shirt on today.
He doesn't have his makeup on either.
You have your time, though.
I do. Always.
Questions of Senator Burns?
I like that.
Senator White.
Keith, I think you mentioned about the accommodations or amendments that were agreed on between the AOI and the legal aid. Didn't you make reference to that?
Yes. There's quite a few of them here, and I think they're generally helpful.
I understood.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question. Are they agreed on?
Well, in part. All the amendments in this document you have are not agreed upon, but they state which ones they are. They go through here in a certain
They have met. There's no point in the future meeting, is that
Well,
correct?
But they don't, there's another set now. These, and I don't know if these have been sent to me or not.
They were sent individually.
Okay. These apparently were sent individually to the members, and they have this AOI ORC comments on legal aid amendments to Senate Bill 163.
That's the last one.
Yes. Now,
I got that.
What I want to say is that the proponents of 163 are not saying they do not agree to these amendments in concept, but I think if they sat down with the proposers of these amendments, they could work out some language that probably would be agreeable to both sides. In other words, I don't think it's necessary for the committee to get involved in these now because they really haven't sat down and gone over them. Now, Mr.
Charlie, can you meet with the opponents and discuss this new document and come to us next Tuesday with what you do agree on and what you don't agree on, or is it layered?
Well, I think both of us can. I think it might be helpful if we could have a legislative council on Richard Winter to meet with us to make sure the language expresses what we want.
Very good.
I thought this would have been done.
This is the great body of amendments. These are new. These are some more. I think the biggest part of it has already been done and been worked out, and there's some here they disagree on, but there's a lot of them they agree on. These other amendments, Senator Hoyt, came in just very recently, and the parties have not sat down and gone over these together. These are unilateral amendments.
Can you meet with
Tuesday's a little early, Senator, to give it a little more time toward the end of the week.
Thursday
would be preferable.
All right.
Fine.
Senator White.
Well, I want you to take another hand and help me. I'm really fouled up on this one. As you recall, when Hugh Briggs was here over 10 days ago, he hadn't seen the other proposal in the Senate. And this other story today, the gentleman, his colleague, they have no reference to amendments, and just want to go as it is. Now, what I'm really hung up on is that there are a lot of different people involved here, and apparently there are only two people talking, and what about everybody else?
No, I'll tell you what's happening, Senator White. Now, as far as Judge Dixon and Henry Carey, there's communication between them and the legal aid attorney insofar as time permits. I mean, it's not perfect communication, but I have no problem about them resolving any difference they have. Now, with respect to Hugh Biggs, there was communication with his office that was going to Manley Strayer.
Yeah, I talked to Manley, and I don't think there's very much communication.
Well, they delivered, I had Charlie Williamson deliver everything, or Laird or Charlie, deliver all of these amendments to their office, and I made two or three phone calls to make sure they did, because I wanted to keep things out of the mix.
Was it delivered or was it with a communication?
Hand delivered, and then Manley Strayer couldn't come down here, so Hugh Biggs came down. And so Hugh had some earlier drafts and didn't have the latest draft that went to Manley Strayer. That's what happened. But nobody, we want full participation on this.
Is that for now participating in the dialogue on these amendments?
Yes, sir. They're going to have an opportunity to participate.
Excuse me. Senator White, I did call Mr. Biggs in response to your request.
And Strayer called me.
I sent them both copies. These various amendments, and I spoke with Mr. Strayer yesterday, and he was sending back to me a response and comments on both amendments, so we should have them within the next day or two.
If we could go tonight, could he call me?
Yeah.
Well, we made every effort because, for instance, Mr. Strayer was going out of town, and I mailed the draft of these amendments to him in California, so he'd have them down there. And so we made every effort to keep full communication between everybody concerned.
Further questions of Senator Burns? Thank you, Senator.
Thank you for giving me an opportunity to testify. I appreciate it.
I'm not sure. You didn't really say there was effective communication.
There will be. I can assure you there'll be no problems today.
That's good, because when I talked to Manley, I don't think you knew anybody else's name. He's a friend of mine.
Well,
you know,
I'm sitting down.
Miss Meyer?
My name is Saul Meyer. I'm a certified public accountant.
You look better to stand up. You look too comfortable.
I'm a member of the State Board of Accountancy, and I'm speaking in support of Senate Bill 469. I do have some background material that was prepared by the State Board that I'd like to distribute, if I may.
We have one from the clerk.
Under the Public Accountancy Act passed in 1951, there was included a prohibition against public accountants operating as a corporation. Now, there was a feeling that due to the confidential and fiduciary relationship between a professional person and his client, that he should practice outside the corporate entity. However, one public accounting firm, the Kunikar Accounting Service, was already practicing public accounting in corporate form, so a special grandfather provision was inserted in the law to permit Kunikar to continue their practice in this corporate form. Hence, this one company was permitted to practice public accounting without conforming to the requirements of the Public Accountancy Act and outside the jurisdiction of the Oregon State Board of Accountancy. In 1969, the Oregon legislature passed the Professional Corporation Act, which permits public accountants as well as other professional people to practice in corporate form with certain restrictions. In 1971, 2 years later, a bill was introduced to the legislature by the State Board of Accountancy, deleting this grandfather clause, which was adopted in 1951, and requiring all public accountants to conform to the Professional Corporation Act if they wish to practice in corporate form. The bill, however, was referred back to the State Board because we had not held a hearing with the Kunikar principals advising them of our intentions. Now, this we have now done. They have been thoroughly advised of the consequences if this bill is approved. They will either be required to follow the same rules as other public accountants, or they can operate as public bookkeepers, dropping the accounting symbol and continue their business as in the past, with this one exception. Now, we feel that this change is in the public interest because the purpose of the Public Accountancy Act and the State Board of Accountancy, as well as other state boards, it is to protect the public from improper and unethical practices. That concludes my brief statement. I'd be very happy to answer your questions.
Thank you. Questions to Mr. Meyer.
You know, I hate to tell you, but I know you're for or against the bill.
I'm for the bill.
You're for the bill.
Yes.
But,
Deleting this grandfather clause,
yeah,
which permits this one company to operate outside the jurisdiction of the State Board of Accountancy.
But the corporation could have often done it.
Well, the legislature in 1969 passed the Professional Act, which permits public accountants as well as other professionals to operate in corporate form, but there are certain restrictions. Now, this particular corporation, this Kunikar Accounting Service, is operating as a corporation, but not as a professional corporation. and we want this company to conform to the regulations required of other public towns. In other words, if they want to operate as a corporation, they should comply with the Professional Corporation Act.
And what are the restrictions that you refer to? They're not in this bill, are they?
No, the restrictions are in the bill that was passed by the legislature in 1969. One major restriction is that all stockholders of a professional corporation must be professional people licensed in that state. So in other words, they can't, they have their corporate stockholders, people who say have no particular interest in the accounting profession. They must be licensed public accountants.
So you're just taking the grandfather clause off?
That's right. In other words, under the, if the grandfather clause is stricken from the bill, why, then everyone must conform to the same requirements.
Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Well, I hate to tell you, but it appears we're certain.
Very good.
Did you,
oh, I'm sorry.
Did you notify the corporation?
John, would you do that, please, that specific corporation?
I haven't seen the rich for quite a while.